with a look at the backcountry. Trent from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning, Trent.
Hi, good morning, Leslie. Yeah, just like Devin said, we're going to have a beautiful day today, and it will be a great day to head out into the backcountry as, you know, there's still plenty of fresh powder out there to be had, and it's going to be a really, really beautiful one. There are still a couple of concerns, and, you know, really close to the Park City ridgeline yesterday, there was an avalanche triggered just off of the West Willow ridgeline, which is, like I mentioned, really close to Park City Ridge. This avalanche was on an east-facing slope at about 9,400 feet in elevation, and it was about 2 feet deep, wide, and it ran about 400 feet down into the flats. The gentleman that triggered it was not caught, but he did say that it took out five of the skiers' tracks from the day before, as well as a skin track, which is what backcountry users hike uphill on. So that was definitely a thing to pay attention to, and it leads us right into our tricky, persistent slab problem that we've had continuing on for, you know, much of the year here, just because of our shallow and thin snowpack that we have in Utah. So, you know, spooky, scary, eerie, weird, frightening, go on ahead and pick your adjective that best describes the moderate danger for triggering one of these avalanches. It continues to be a low probability for triggering an avalanche, but the consequences remain constant, just meaning that, you know, the likelihood of triggering one of these is pretty low, but if you do trigger one, they're deep and they're dangerous avalanches, and you can get pretty banged up by these things. We've had several close calls throughout Utah the past couple of days. So the bottom line is that a moderate danger exists in the mid to upper elevation west to north to east facing slopes, and human triggered avalanches 1 to 3 feet deep remain possible in this terrain. The safest and arguably the best riding conditions can be found on shady, sheltered terrain on low-angle slopes with no overhead hazard. I would encourage your users, if you're going to head out into the backcountry today, or excuse me, your listeners, to visit UtahAvalancheCenter.org to get the full forecast.
Okay, Trent, thank you. Well, the Utah legislature enters its second week of the 45-day session on the phone with a recap of week one. And a look ahead, I have Brian Schaut, managing editor of UtahPolicy.com. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
So any big highlights from the first week?
Well, we started off with a bang as House Speaker Greg Hughes announced in his first in his opening day remarks that the state would be launching a lawsuit against the opioid in the industry. That came as a big surprise to the Attorney General's office, because they weren't really ready to move forward with that. So Speaker Hughes just sort of put them in a bind, and they had to have a hastily called press conference and say, yeah, we're looking at it. So that was an interesting bit on day one. Governor Gary Herbert delivered his State of the State address on Wednesday. It was probably one of the best State of the State addresses I've heard him give. It was his eighth, so, you know, he's been doing this a long time, but that was probably the best one he's done so far. And then there was just lots of talk about the budget, really digging into the budget early on so far this year, and a couple of really big issues. We had an abortion bill pop up that caught a lot of attention. They passed a number of bills to overhaul the state's education statutes, clean up some language and things. So it was a really, really impactful first week, and they got off to a fast start. It's been a long time since I've seen something like this.
Well, let's dig a little bit deeper. Let's start with budget and taxes. Of course, we had heard from you last week that tax reform was going to be a big issue, but I think the problem still, we don't know how the federal tax reform impacts the state of Utah yet.
Yeah, exactly. It looks like the state is going to get a windfall from federal tax reform. They don't know how big yet. They say anywhere between 25 and $80 million of extra money to spend this year. Well, that's good. But the reason they're getting it is because of the tax cuts on the federal level and changes to the tax code on the federal level, people in Utah will be paying more on their state income taxes. And so there's a big windfall on that. So lawmakers are talking about doing a slight income tax cut for 2018, It's not going to be very much. Somewhere maybe around a tenth of a percent. Right now, you know, we have a flat tax of 5%. They're thinking about maybe getting close down to 4.9% on that. So people really aren't going to notice it that much. They will notice if they pay more on their state taxes, but they're probably not going to notice a cut all that much. So they're trying to do that. Another thing that's happening on the budget is we learned that in the base budgeting process, the fiscal analyst for the legislature identified about $162 million worth of cuts to the base budget that they would like lawmakers to really dig into this year. And the House and the Senate had to warn their members, you better take these recommendations seriously and give them a really thorough look. And part of the reason why they had to issue that warning is because lawmakers didn't want to look into some of these program cuts because they make cuts to popular programs and they didn't want to get the political heat that comes along with it. Well, that's just a continuation. The reason it used to be that the individual budget committees were tasked with, okay, you need to cut 2% or 1% or a certain amount from the budget, and then they would go through the budgets of their committees, fine-tooth comb, and find those cuts, and then there would be a lot of heat that came their way. Well, they didn't like that heat, so they now gave it to the Office of the Fiscal Analyst. So the fiscal analyst now goes through the budgets and tries to identify places to cut. And again, lawmakers don't like that because it brings heat to them. So there was a warning on the Hill saying you better take this seriously. I don't know if they're going to actually make those cuts. They might move some of the money around. But don't forget, lawmakers have an extra $500 million to spend this year, and that's not including the windfall they're going to get from the federal government. So there's a lot of talk about the budget, a lot of games being played with the budget right now, trying to find some inefficiencies. We should be wrapped up with the base budget process soon, and then they can move on to the full budget for next year.
Of course, another big expenditure each year is on transportation. Tell me what's going on here. You'd mentioned maybe toll roads, more of them.
Well, yeah, what Senate President Wayne Niederhauser told me, he sort of feels like a canary in a coal mine with infrastructure spending, especially for transportation. He's trying to get lawmakers to focus on this because, you know, the state just spent a couple billion dollars revamping our roads, and already there's a lot of congestion on the roads. Capacity is starting to fill up on our roads, and the state's population is expected to double sometime in the next 20 to 30 years. So the problem is only going to get worse. So President Niederhauser has proposed a bill that would allow a toll booth at the entrance to Little Cottonwood Canyon. It would not be a toll booth per se. It would be electronic tolling. What he's doing is trying to change the statute, update our tolling statute so you can move to electronic tolling instead of a toll booth. And the reason why, he said, this is a long-term vision. The state is going to have to do something to pay for roads because we've got a lot of alternative fuel vehicles getting on the roads. They said when you get to 10 to 12%, the gas tax just doesn't cut it anymore. It will not be able to keep up with demand. It doesn't keep up with demand as it is right now because they're already pulling $600 million out of the general fund to pay for roads to make up for the shortfall of what they don't get in the gas tax. So this is a long-term thought process that he's doing. The state is going to have to find some way to pay for these roads. They've floated higher fees, higher licensure fees, tolling, something along those lines, but the state is going to have to do something to pay for road upkeep and road expansion because our roads are not going to be able to handle the crush of people that we're going to see along the Wasatch Front in the next 2 to 3 decades.
Yeah, and I'm surprised they're shying away from more gas taxes then. I mean, when you look at the gas taxes in California, I mean, ours don't come close to that.
Well, they did address the gas tax a couple of years ago.
Right.
And they indexed it for inflation. The problem is gas prices have fallen since then. They did these projections based on the gas tax, you know, the price of a gallon of gas being over $4. And it's now $2.50. You know, the gas prices fell. And so the gas taxes are not keeping up. I just don't sense there's an appetite this year to go in and reindex all these gas taxes again. They're eventually going to have to do something. I just don't see that there's an appetite this year to really go do another huge overhaul when they're looking at so many other big issues this year, including the income tax cut that we were talking about, how to deal with federal tax reform. They just don't feel like they're going to do it this year, and they're going to start to make up things with higher fees. And don't forget, 2018 is an election year, and politically, they're not going to be able to get anywhere near putting $600 million into transportation that they're taking out of the general fund right now. That's just not a reality. They're not going to be able to do that, because that's how a lot of people lose their jobs, and this is an election year. So you're not going to see that happen this year, but they've got to do something. They know this is a problem that is heading down the turnpike at them at full speed, and they're going to have to figure it out sooner rather than later.
The issue of abortion back, lawmakers moving ahead with an abortion bill that their attorneys say is probably unconstitutional. My understanding is that this bill would protect fetuses that have been diagnosed as potentially Down syndrome babies?
Yeah, Representative Carrie-Ann Lisenby has a bill that prohibits abortion if the sole reason for the abortion is that the child is going to be born with Down syndrome. On bills, there's a thing called a constitutional note. Legislative lawyers look over and say whether it has a likelihood of being found unconstitutional. They revamped that process a number of years ago because lawmakers kept getting these constitutional notes on some of the message bills they were trying to send, and they didn't like it because people would then beat them up in the press, in committee hearings, saying, hey, you were pushing an unconstitutional bill. So they reformed it, making it harder to get these unconstitutional notes. So now if a note is put on a bill that says this has a high likelihood of being found unconstitutional, that means it's probably extremely unconstitutional, just simply because of the process the legislature put in place. This bill has been told, they've been told by their lawyers, this has a high likelihood of being found unconstitutional, and it is just begging for a lawsuit. They moved it out of the Rules Committee over the objection of Republicans, and here's the objection of Democrats. And here's one of the little tricks they did in the Rules Committee, and you see this all the time up on the Hill. Normally, you would think that this bill dealing with a medical procedure would go to the Health and Human Services Committee. There are family doctors on that committee. That's not where they sent it. They sent it to the Judiciary Committee, where there are more conservative lawmakers who would be much more apt to passing it, and they moved it out of the committee to the House floor. So this bill is still moving through the process. Our Republicans are playing games with it, and you look at it and you're like, gee, what a surprise. It's an election year, and we have an abortion bill.
Yeah. Speaking of that, let's move on to the sex education. We have a representative wanting to change our sex education rules because what some teachers aren't teaching, what they should be teaching.
Representative Ray Ward has found, and he's a family doctor, but he has found that a lot of high school teachers are simply skipping the part in sex ed about contraceptives because there is a directive in state law that says that you cannot teach in a way that promotes the use of contraceptives. You can't teach in a way that kids will want to use contraceptives. And so a lot of teachers, for fear of running afoul of that, are just not teaching the unit on contraceptives. And his point is, you know, 80-90% of people are going to use contraceptives at some point in their life. That's just a fact. So why not just remove this directive from the state law so the teachers will actually teach this important part of sex ed instead of letting it go? So it's just I'm not sure. I haven't really been able to suss out, you know, what the appetite for this is, whether they're going to pass it or whether it's favorable for it to pass or not. But what it looks like is he's just trying to make it easier for teachers to teach kids about contraceptives when they're learning sex ed. And it seems to make a lot of sense.
Okay. Real quick, what's going on with hate crimes?
Senator Daniel Thatcher has brought he hates the term hate crimes. He calls it victim targeting bill. And what this bill does is, if you are convicted of a crime, and this is where it differs from hate crimes, if you are convicted for a crime, and then they prove that you committed the crime because you were targeting somebody for a particular reason, then it has enhanced penalties. The old hate crimes legislation would add enhanced penalties in the prosecution phase before a crime was proven. They were saying, we think you did this crime because this person was gay or this person was black or Latino. Now they've sort of flipped it on its head. You are guilty of this crime, so you are going to have this penalty. We are going to try and add on an extra penalty because we think you did it for this reason, and here's why. So it's sort of flipping it around. A lot of religious leaders have gotten behind this bill. There's still a lot of conservatives who do not like this legislation in the legislature, simply because they say you're prosecuting thought. You cannot prosecute someone for something they're thinking. You can't punish someone for something that they're thinking. So they don't like that at all. So it's still on very tenuous ground. The second time he's tried to do this, he wasn't even able to get it to a committee last year because there was such opposition to it by legislative leadership. He's hoping he'll be able to get it to a committee and a little bit further through the process this year. But it's a very controversial piece of legislation.
And finally, it sounds like something may be brewing with our concealed carry permits.
Yeah, it's something to watch. It's sort of buried down in this. What they're doing is, right now, a concealed carry permit, it costs $15. To renew it, it costs $15. Well, the cost of processing these permits is going up. So, in a committee, there's a bill that is proposing to raise the fee to just under $25 from $15, and this is just to cover the cost, the increased cost of processing these permits. Well, the National Rifle Association, the NRA, they do not like this fee increase at all. And so they are starting a full-scale press against it, saying that the state is trying to profit off of it. They're trying to get their membership to oppose it. And that's not right, because if you look at state law, the state cannot profit off of the processing of these permits. They're just not allowed to do it. They're not allowed to build up a fund or anything. And so
we've got to see then. Hey, Brian, thanks for your time this morning.
Okay.
Brian Schott, Managing Editor of UtahPolicy.com. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, going into Sundance this year, Park City Municipal had three goals: to reduce single-occupant vehicles, to decrease traffic and congestion in residential neighborhoods, and to create a consistent and predictable transportation plan. In the studio to tell us how they did, I have Transportation Planning Manager Alfred Knotts, along with Special Events Manager Jenny Dearson. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So if you were to give yourself a grade, how did you guys do?
I'll let Jenny answer that. She has boots on the ground.
Okay.
I would just say I think we did a really good job, and I think the community did a really good job at stepping up to the plate and trying the. I mean, we tried so many new things this year, coupled with Sundance and the county and all of our community partners. So just congratulations, I would say, to the community for stepping up to the plate.
Let's talk a little bit about some of those changes. Some of those were just route changes.
We were able to change some of the transit routes in coordination with Sundance. Adding Richardson Flats all 10 days of the festival really did make an impact. Also, bringing the bus on as a partner and then also some additional Proterra buses really helped us create efficiencies within the various transit routes, existing transit routes. It's the first year we had the Electric Express as
Correct.
Well. But again, all of those things kind of coupled together with the new parking implementation program and a tiered approach, really. So in-town parking was more expensive to encourage people to park on the outside of town and to take the bus. So all of that work all together really helped pull it together.
Well, let's start with the out-of-town parking there at Richardson Flat. I mean, did we see good use there?
Yes. I think our transit guys and Sundance was monitoring that, and we saw about an average of 250 cars per day. So last year we only did it about 4 days, and the one big day was when we had the Women's March, obviously. But yeah, we saw consistency across the board for all those 10 days, and I think it was a well-funded investment.
Yeah. I mean, any idea if they were workers or were those actually coming in to, you know, from outlying areas to come watch movies? Do we have any idea?
So I think it was a mix of both. I used Richardson Flats the last 5 days of the festival. And again, I think it was there were some, you know, skiers. There were definitely moviegoers and there were employees on that bus as well. I was coming in right around 10 o'clock or 11 in the morning and leaving town around midnight. And, you know, it was impressive to see how many people were actually utilizing the bus. I caught a bus at the high school and it was a good mix, especially on Saturday, of people heading up to the resort, attending movies and also going to work. So I think that's an exciting thing to see. I also love when I'm riding home at night, seeing community members that I haven't seen for a long time and being able to talk to them. I know Elizabeth on our communications team was actually out on the buses gathering real-time feedback, both positive and constructive feedback of a few items we can tweak in the future.
Yeah. So the route with the Richardson Flat, because no one likes to make that left-hand turn, so you had them come out right, and then where did they go?
The Richardson Flat bus.
Yeah,
they did turn.
They did turn out.
Yes, mm-hmm. But some of the congestion, obviously, it does help them get out. But people did yield to the bus, and we got feedback from the drivers also about how that did function. We do have a signal plan there in the future as part of the 248 project and build out of PC Heights also. So in the future, that'll be more. It'll be more formal out there. So.
Yeah, and the same thing coming out of the high school there as well. They had to make a left turn.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was a little it's challenging. But, yeah, they're, you know, well-versed in the operation.
Yeah. You do note room for improvement. One of those is how and where to transfer.
So I think that's just a little bit more details. One of the things I also admire is how friendly the bus drivers are when you do get on the bus. And they do everything to try and get you where you need to go. When the buses are full, they don't have quite as high touch as they do when the buses are less full. And so just really making sure people know the best bus to catch. Several times I asked, well, will this bus get me to this location? And they said yes, but catch this bus, is that one will get you there faster. That one will get you in front of the high school instead of to the back of the high school, so on and so forth. So I think the plan is, again, just to make sure that people know which bus is the best for them and just increasing our customer service.
Yeah. And I guess in terms of consistency there, I mean, it seemed like some theater loop buses would stop at regular bus stops, but others wouldn't. I mean, are they required to stop at every bus stop if somebody's there?
If it's a theater loop, then they would stop sometimes if they do see people at the regular stops. This is the first year of LaBus doing it. So I think some of those drivers may have not been as informed with the operation as past. So they obviously try to accommodate riders as much as they can.
Yeah, yeah. And I know that if you ask them, they would stop.
Correct.
But it was flagging them down to stop if you were at the bus stop that may not have been a shuttle stop. What about the Electric Express? You had to bring on more?
We have six of those, and during non-peak we run about four, but to keep those 10-minute headways, sometimes we do put six into operation because if they get stuck in congestion or get off of their routes, we'll run all six of those. So we did run those at the peak. I think that's important to mention is that we leveraged that route extensively throughout the whole operation. So that allowed us to put other resources, such as running the Richardson Flat Lot, 10 out of the 10 days. So that really helped us improve efficiencies. And then the Temple route also, we ran from Temple to Canyons rather than bringing the Temple bus all the way in. It did require a transfer, but that Electric Express allowed us to increase that efficiency also.
Yep. So were you able to run? I mean, could that have been a stop on the Electric Express? Pulling in and out of the Temple?
No. We have to maintain what our routes are for federal dollars. We can't modify those routes with the federal dollars that we run or the federal routes that we run. So Sundance supplemental routes, we're able to run that route. So we had to make that connection at the Canyons Village.
All right. So there was just a smaller bus than that was running from Canyons back to the
Temple. Correct. More direct.
Okay. So that was probably the easiest way to do it.
Correct.
Did people know where to pick up, though, that?
They did. And again, as Jenny mentioned, the drivers are very informative to the riders, as well as the Sundance volunteers as well. So they were able to inform people of that connection.
Yeah. One of the biggest challenges you noted, Jenny, was the stop sign there at Park Avenue.
So we just noticed it's great when we're working out there. We have Alfred and Kenzie and police out there, and we're just watching everything that's going on. So one of the pinch points we saw is on Park Avenue at 7th Street and 9th Street, and we watched that. We're considering, you know, already looking at next year some additional pedestrian management and some possible additional traffic mitigation to help transit get through. That is our priority during the festival, is moving things around to see what we can do to expedite transit and make sure those that are riding the bus can get there as quick as possible. And we understand that especially during those peak times, especially the first weekend, that that some of those areas slows down transit. So those are the things that we want to work on.
Yeah, I avoided Main Street the first weekend. How did it go there?
You know, I think it went very well. I can't give enough props to our police department, the streets department, the bus drivers, and then also the residential mitigation that we had there, that we're really trying to help keep people out of the neighborhoods that shouldn't be up in the neighborhoods. And that's always something that we're looking to improve. We did that on the 4th of July in Arts Fest as well. So again, lots of work, not only for the city, but again, all of our community partners, the employees in the restaurants, I think almost 2,000 you know, volunteers at Sundance. So much work just went into the last 2 weeks and the last couple of months as well, and we really appreciate everyone.
Yeah. I mean, in years past, though, we've seen Main Street just not move. And was that the case? I mean, things kept flowing?
Things kept flowing. Simple as that, they were moving. I have to say, operations for Lyft, which was back on Sweet Alley, we saw that that was not conflicting with the transit center, which is something that we were concerned about. And watching, and they worked very closely with us throughout the entire festival. Any kind of issues we saw, they immediately fixed them. So transit and transportation were moving, and again, just getting into the debriefing process, and hopefully we'll be back to council within the next month or two to give a full debrief and get some data behind all of that as well.
Yeah, any feedback at this point from Main Street merchants?
You know, I checked in with Michael Burrell a few times during the festival, and while they don't have specific feedback right now, one of the things we did do is come up with a loading zone for some of the merchants that were in the taxi zones, so that they had a little more time to get into their shops if they needed to deliver more milk to a cafe or whatever it might be. But we're looking forward to that debrief process with them as well.
Right. And so at this point, we really don't know numbers. So even though it may have felt less crowded and less congested, there could have been less people, or we don't think so?
So I know from Sundance that they saw about an 8% increase in ticket sales, so I don't think it was less congested. I just think it was a more well-oiled machine.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about China Bridge. It was full the first week, and then basically a ghost town. Was that what you had hoped? My guess is that you'd hope to make some money off of the parking there.
Yeah, I mean, our pay structure is really intended not really to generate revenue, but to change behavior. So we wanted to be consistent across the board. We will talk to Michael, and we'll talk to the HPCA and see how that did affect their businesses, both positive and negative. But yeah, we'll respond accordingly and adjust that structure. And that's really what the adaptive pricing is intended to do.
Yeah, and in years past, we've seen the price go down per day. We didn't see that at all. Is that something you'll reconsider then? Or
we will always reconsider that. But again, had we dropped that price, let's pretend we dropped it down to $20, we would have seen that garage fill, and we would have seen congestion in the Old Town area. So we are focused on our three goals that we had, and we are going to be having that conversation. One of the things we had hoped to do early on was to have an hourly rate, and we had estimated that rate was going to be $8. We changed that just a couple weeks before the festival because we watched how it worked with peak operations during the holiday. And so that is something that as we lead into summer and start planning for next year's festival, we hope that we're able to implement that hourly rate, and that will likely come back and help with some of those patrons that want to come to Main Street for just a few hours instead of longer periods of time. I do want to touch really quickly that Homesteak was an incredible success, also being very much so filled the first weekend, and then we saw that lot operate around 70% full for the rest of the festival. I do want to remind folks out there that are working on Main Street that Homesteak doesn't stop, and that was part of our consistency in the plan, is to run that lot just like we do the rest of the year. So that will continue to run with with transit from 12 o'clock in the afternoon until 4 a.m. throughout the rest of the year, so you can keep on parking out there and help us make a difference in the transportation plan around the year.
Oh, we had talked maybe you would be decreasing those hours a little bit, but you're going to stick with that 4 a.m. through the
season. I just talked to Kenzie, and for now we are going to stick with those that time frame.
Okay. Real quick, if people do have something to say about how it went for them, you're happy to hear from them.
Yeah, we have a couple of ways. So number one is you can send comments directly to staff. You can just email specialevents@parkcity.org. You can also send any feedback to SEAC@parkcity.org. I do want to remind everyone that our next SEAC meeting, that's the Special Events Advisory Committee, is going to be on February 21st at noon at the Park City Library. And then also just a quick mention that there is a transportation survey that you can participate on. If you just go to the homepage of parkcity.org, it's just right there, and you can give your feedback that way as well. And again, I can't thank the community enough for all of their work and all they did to help us implement the plan.
Okay. We're going to be talking with you next week then, Alfred, to talk a little bit more about 248 and 224 and get an update on that. All right. Yes. Anything else you wanted to add about Sundance, though, in particular?
I'll just second what Jenny just said. You know, we acted and the community responded. This is a very important event, and our strategy has been to focus on these peak days. Sundance obviously being one. President's Weekend coming up. We know people aren't always going to ride transit every day, but during these peak times, we like to see people take advantage of the alternatives that we provide.
Okay. Alfred, Jenny, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:42. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Joining me now in the studio from U.S. Ski and Snowboard, Tom Kelly. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Leslie. Sundance over, huh?
Sundance over, and we're moving right into the Olympics. Let's talk a little bit about what we've got. We've got, I think, all of the teams named, yeah?
Everything's named now, and we're ready to go. The official team naming was this past Friday, with the U.S. Olympic Committee naming 240-some athletes overall to Team USA, and of those, 109 individual athletes with 110 spots. We have one interesting situation where Devin Logan has qualified both in slopestyle and in halfpipe, probably one of the stronger teams that we've ever had before. A significant number of medalists on this team, and you know, an opportunity for us to really achieve the goal of being best in the world when we get to Pyeongchang.
Yeah, and I know that Youth Sports Alliance is putting together a report showing the number of Park City bred athletes that are part of the snow sports. So pretty impressive. I mean, like a fifth, I think, of all of the athletes going to South Korea.
Yeah, it really is impressive what this state and particularly this community has represented. You know, it's been our home since the 70s, and there's really quite a culture here for Olympic sports. So I think the number for Park City connected athletes is over 50. So, you know, it's a pretty large number when you consider this small community and how many Olympians it's producing.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about some of the racing that we saw. Ted Ligety back on the podium.
Yeah, it was really good to see that this weekend. Ted's had an okay season, but not kind of the Ted of old, but he was throwing stuff in that second run in Garmisch that he hasn't been throwing for a while. Been 3 years since he's been on a World Cup podium, so it was really good to see. Third place, he wants to notch it up a little bit more, but you know, he showed really for the first time, I think, this season that he can go to the Olympics and he can contend for that GS gold medal. And I know that that's been his goal and his target the last few years. It's been frustrating for him. He bailed out on the World Championship season last year in order to go have some surgery. And I think right now we're seeing that it's paying off. He got a good rest going into that event. He'll have another good rest going into the Olympics.
Yep. So is he healthy? I mean, back issues are often nagging.
He's really pretty healthy right now, and you could see that in his skiing. I mean, you see it through the angulation of he's doing. He threw in a couple of stivets or jump turns and, you know, doing things that really take some good physical conditioning. And I think that's the thing that really buoyed a lot of our enthusiasm, was just seeing how he approached that second run, how he went for the win. He didn't get the win. He is a little bit back from Marcel Hirscher, but he was out there looking like the Ted of old.
Yeah. And Michaela Schifrin, oh my gosh, that was unbelievable. So unlike her to see her not finish.
Yeah, it It really was. And, you know, frankly, if she can get it out of her system now, that's great. So when she gets to the Olympics, she's starting fresh. But it was really frustrating, you know, to have a win in hand and then to lose it. But she's going to go into the Olympics in good shape and in good spirits. She has an excellent plan. And when we get to Pyeongchang, she has the ideal schedule for her. It starts with a giant slalom on Monday, opening ceremony on Friday, and then 3 days later, she does a giant slalom, takes a one-day break, and then comes back with the slalom to defend her title. And the beauty of this schedule is that those technical events come before the speed events, which is unusual. Speed events will be later, and there's a little bit of a break, so she'll have an opportunity to evaluate how she did in the GS and slalom and decide how many events she wants to compete in. She can compete in any of the six events that we have, including the first-ever team event. We'll see what she chooses to do.
All right. And then Lindsay Fond taking a fourth in the combined race. I'm hearing that there may be talk that we're going to do away with this event. Is that true?
The combined, there's a lot of discussion on right now, and it's changed a lot over the years. It seems like the rules on it are ever changing. Yeah, there's for sure a discussion about its future, but I wouldn't count it out yet. I think it's still a pretty exciting event. And, you know, for Lindsay to come into that, she doesn't ski much or any slalom anymore. To finish fourth in the combined is a pretty good signal, too, that she's going to be able to go to the Olympics and be a contender in three events, the downhill and the Super G, where she was just a hundredth off first in the test events a year ago to Ilka Stuich. And the fact that she can compete in the Alpine combined and be that competitive. So fourth, good sign, not a podium, but a really good sign for her.
Okay. And what are some of the highlights with the cross-country team?
You know, this was quite an amazing weekend for cross-country, both on the men's and the women's side. Last event before they head over. They're in Seefeld, Austria, site of the 2019 World Championships. And it was a two-for-two win day for the USA on Saturday in a freestyle sprint. It was Sophie Caldwell picking up a victory, her first World Cup win in a couple of seasons. And she now has the bookends of both a freestyle and a classic sprint World Cup win. She actually tied with Lorien van der Graaf of Switzerland in a super exciting finish. And then on Sunday, Jesse Diggins came back with just a spectacular win in the 10K freestyle mass start. Neither of these are Olympic disciplines, but it just really sent some amazing messages out about the depth of this women's team. Sadie Bjornsson finishing eighth in the 10K freestyle, the best ever for her at that distance and that technique. Keegan Randall was in the top 14. And we go into the Olympics right now with Jesse Diggins in third overall in the World Cup. Sadie Bjornsson ranked seven in the world. And then on the men's side, really unprecedented results. Erik Bjornsson in the top 10, finishing ninth, a career best for him, and Simi Hamilton, a career best distance event in 12th. So good signs for them. Erik Bjornsson is somebody who's going to kind of sneak up on us, I think, at the Olympics, and won't consider him a medal contender, but somebody that's just been making really good progress in the distance events. And I think the men's relay at the Olympics, while not challenging for a medal like the women, is going to be, you know, formidable compared to where we've been the last few years.
Okay. And then also competing in the X Games at Aspen this past week.
Yeah, big X Games performances. And, you know, it was the stars. The stars that we really expect to do well did pretty well at the X Games. David Wise and Maddie Bowman, the defending gold medalists in halfpipe skiing, they picked up the gold medals at the X Games. Jamie Anderson, slopestyle snowboarding, picked up a gold there. Maggie Voisin, one to watch, 19 years old. She was 15 in Sochi. She was one of the three athletes who was hurt leading into the Games. She's on fire right now. Had a strong qualifying run to make the Olympic team, and she picked up her first X Games gold, winning slopestyle skiing. And Chloe Kim also pretty much showing where she's at, picking up gold in the halfpipe snowboarding event. So pretty good X Games. Everybody now kind of focused on where we're going, and that is on to Pyeongchang. It is just 10 days away from opening ceremony.
Okay, so when do you head over?
I'm heading over this Thursday, and are going to spend 3-4 weeks over there, so it should be a good run. We have an amazing team. You know, I think the fact that in this team we have 18 Olympic medalists on this team going there, and that's 12 individual athletes who have won Olympic medals before. A lot of experience on this team, and the newcomers, people like Chloe Kim, are coming in on fire right now. So fingers crossed, everybody stays healthy. I think it's going to be an amazing Olympic Games for U.S. ski and snowboard.
So you'll be making reports a couple times a week at least.
Yeah, what I'd like to do is we'll come to you, if it works, in this time slot, 8:40 a.m. Park City time, Monday, Wednesday and Friday, if that works out, and bringing you all the latest. A lot of exciting news going to be happening over there.
So you're 16 hours ahead. If people haven't seen the event, I mean, are they being played live?
Yeah, every single minute of every event will be streamed live, and the television coverage will be different than we've seen in the past. For example, the primetime show will not be delayed in this time zone. It'll be live beginning at 8 o'clock Park City time. Over 600 hours of television coverage and over 150 hours of broadcast coverage on NBC's flagship station. So no shortage of coverage. Just get the NBC Olympics app.
Okay. I'm just wondering, though, if people don't want to spoil anything, you're not going to do it for them.
No, actually, I'll be reporting on things that will already have been pretty well reported. That's 1240 a.m., just after midnight, my time in Pyeongchang, coming to you at 8:40 in the morning here in Park City.
Okay. Tom, we'll talk to you from South Korea.
Thanks. Wish us luck.
It's 8:52. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, author, editor, and historian David Hampshire will be at the Park City Museum Education and Collections Center in Prospector this Friday evening. He joins me now in the studio to talk a little bit more about his new Pop Jenks book. He's also joined by Museum Director Sandra Morrison. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, back in the mid-1980s, we were approached, the museum was approached by Thelma Uriarte, who is the daughter of Pop Jenks. And unknown to us, she had a trunk in her house with about 600 negatives and prints of his that he had taken over the years between about 1913 and 1970. And she offered to donate those to the museum. And that led to an exhibit of photographs. You may remember that at the Kimball Art Center in the fall of 1987. And shortly after that, we published a modest book of his photographs that went out of print, I'm guessing, 10 years ago, Sandra? Or, I mean, it hasn't been available in that period of time, I think.
Yeah, about 2007, I think, we sold the last copy.
And so Sandra has been on my case ever since about doing an update of the book. And we finally, with the help of Stacy Mullally, Stacy Domalski. We managed to put together a remake of that book. It's actually has a lot of new information and new photographs in it as well.
All right, so it's not just a picture book. It's a history book.
Yes, okay. Yeah. But the emphasis is obviously on Pop Jenks photos. You know, he's the star of the show here. And I wrote a new biography and new captions for the photos. Some of the photos were in the original book, but there are a lot of them that were not.
Okay, well, we're talking like we know who he is because we do, but tell us who was Pop Jenks.
Okay, good question. He was a traveling photographer who ran into a guy in Provo sometime in 1912. Pop was in Provo taking photos of mothers and their children kind of thing. He'd go house to house. And this guy told him, he said, you know, we could use a guy like you up in Park City. And so he took the train up here, and he arrived here in January of 1913. And he tells a story that he had a dollar and a quarter in his pocket, which wasn't enough money to take the train back out of town. And so he said, basically, I stayed here for the next 57 years after that. And it was a struggle for him because, as it turned out, there was another local photographer whose name was Willis Adams. So he had some competition in town, but he managed to make a go of it. He opened a storefront here in 1917, a storefront studio at the bottom of Main Street near where the Park Hotel is now, and managed to limp along, and he started selling other things to help supplement his income. He sold phonographs and then radios and then fishing tackle and all kinds of other stuff. And he finally settled in a storefront location, which still stands today just below Cafe Terrigo, and I believe it's Park City Jewelry that's
yes.
in there, Park City Jewelers. That building still stands, and he was in there by about 1925, and that was his studio and his storefront from then on.
And he also, I mean, when you look at the picture that you guys got on the email, he also sold confectionaries, so sweets. He was the penny candy store.
Well, starting in the mid-1930s, he decided that he still couldn't make a living selling phonographs. You know, in those days, a record player and a radio, they'd sell for $300 and up, you know. And in those days, you could buy a car for $500. A new Chevy cost $5.25, you know. So people didn't have money for those kinds of luxuries. And so he went into the confectionery business in 1934 and sold ice cream and served hamburgers and candy and made a living doing that. And in 1937, he opened a second location down near where Squatters is now on the highway.
Yeah. And he also had a public telephone booth, huh, back in there. I see the telephone sign on the photo.
Yeah, I think the other thing that, you know, overtook him was the recession, the Great Depression. And, of course, Park City's economy, like the rest of the country, declined rapidly. And so he had, you know, I mean, photography was a luxury, and so he had to look for some other way to support his family.
Yeah. Sure. So he wasn't a photographer then, a news photographer for the Park Record then, huh?
No. It was all commercial photography, studio work. He took a lot of photos of sports teams, basketball, football, baseball, and the band. A lot of the Park City had a great band at that time. Well, they still do, and so he took a lot of those on Main Street, of the band marching up Main Street. Most of the parades went up Main Street at that time. And so there was just a mass of photos. And the quality on these is just remarkable, because he used large format camera. And some of these are negatives. The negatives are as big as 8 by 10 inches. And so you just get stunning detail in some of these photographs. I mean, he was a master at what he did.
And how did he come across the name Pop?
Well, the Jenks part, I guess his wife used to call him Jenks, which is short for Jenkins. His real name was Joseph Edward Jenkins. And Thelma, his daughter, thinks that the Pop came because his hair turned gray prematurely, and so he kind of looked older than his years.
Okay. So, again, you're going to be at the new Education Center Friday, 5 to 6:30. The book will be there for sale.
Yes.
You'll be signing it.
Yeah. I'm going to give a little presentation first.
Okay. And then, Sandra, you'll have the book at the museum there.
Yeah,
for
and
sale
the book's
well?
For sale at the museum as well. Yeah, it's $24.95, and we have lots of copies, and I'm going to get David to sign them, so they'll be signed by the author. So come to the book signing on Friday night. It'll be a great presentation. David's been working on this book for us for a few years now. So
yes.
We're all very pleased to see it actually in print and a hard copy.
Okay, and let's just mention really quickly, next Wednesday you've got another lecture on Lewis and Clark, and then the following week on Tuesday the 13th, Abandoned Ship Part 2. So you're really making good use of the new collection
center.
Yeah,
you know, part of the reason of building the building was our conference room at the museum could really only hold 30 people comfortably, and we were getting 60 people showing up for our lecture series. So the new building's fabulous. We have lots of room. So come on by.
Okay, thanks for coming in.